2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 375, Shall the Youth of Zion Falter? A panel by Young Gay Mormons. With panelists Jed Brubaker, Aaron Cloward, and Stephen Schroy.
Welcome to Session 375, Panel, Shall the Youth of Zion Falter? My name is Dwayne Jennings. I'm a former chapter director of the Wasatch Chapter of Affirmation Gay and Lesbian Mormons, and I'm still involved locally and nationally with the organization. For example, I currently represent Affirmation at the National Religious Leadership Roundtable, an organization of some 60-plus national religious, religions, and religious-affiliated groups that support GLBT, gay, lesbian, bi, transgendered, and intersex people of faith from many different traditions. When I was given the abstract of the workshop with this title, the words of the hymn popped into my mind, which I remember, in defeating truth and right, will the enemy assail us? Shall we shrink or shun the fight? As we start this workshop, I would like for people to keep in mind a couple of questions. Do we understand God? Do we understand creation? Do we understand what love is and how to teach and support the expansion or growth of love in ourselves and in our communities? Do we understand what truth and righteousness are completely? Before I get further, I should mention that there will be tapes of this session out at the front table for sale afterwards. And we'll go from there. The abstract for this panel reads, even though the LDS Church denies that there is such a thing as gay people, but rather people with homosexual problems, never before have there been so many young Mormons openly identifying themselves as gay. In this panel, a group of young people of LDS backgrounds will explore the following questions. How do young gay Mormons preserve their LDS identity? At what age and how do they start their coming out process? What are some of the challenges they face, and where do they turn for support? Back in the mid-1990s, a number of members of Affirmation recognized the growing need of our young adult and youth population in the church, and felt that there was a growing need for help out there. We set forward to develop a support for them, which resulted after about a year and a half of releasing a mission statement and creating a network. And that in part reads, Affirmation Gay and Lesbian Mormons endorses community-based and national initiatives which assist youth and young adults who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, or questioning their sexuality. Affirmation's youth services relies upon such initiatives to promote positive emotional, spiritual, and psychological development among Mormon-affiliated youth and young adults who struggle with their sexual orientation. We provide information about and referrals to such initiatives. Affirmation serves as a link between community resources and young individuals in need. Our vision, Affirmation believes health and wellness is possible for Mormon-affiliated GLBTQ people of all ages who accept themselves. By supporting these service initiatives that believe similarly, we hope to preserve the physical and spiritual lives of GLBTQ youth and thereby reduce risk behaviors, including interpersonal violence, suicide and other self-destructive acts, alcoholism, racism, HIV transmission, sexual and emotional exploitation, substance abuse, dropping out of school, running away, and exposure to unhealthy adult role models and environments which seek to exploit with youth sexually, physically, spiritually, and emotionally. Our network is patterned on a number, well, most specifically, the Center of Disease Control in Atlanta and some of the networks that they have set up. And we have professional people from several fields across the country that we work with, both in and outside of the LDS Church. It's from this where I come from, and as moderator, I will mention that I believe in God, I am a person of faith, and I believe in the creative force of the universe, and in what I call the spirit of the restoration of all things, eternal progression, and searching for new truths and an expanded understanding. Over the next hour, we will hear confirming and conflicting points of view, good and bad experiences that young adult members of the church are having. It is a time to share some of the problems and hopefully some solutions. Please be respectful of each person's experience. As we attempt this, let us keep in mind how we can better understand and implement the gospel of Jesus Christ in our lives, in growing and progressing that line upon line that we so often like to quote. Our panelists include Jed Brubaker, who has been involved with the LGBT youth mental health for six years and is currently the director of Affirmations Youth Services. As a clinical psychology student at the University of Utah, his current research is focused on interpersonal communication and support in sharing coming out stories and the effects on identity development, enculturation, and well-being. Jed comes from a family of 10 and is in a wonderful relationship with the love of his life, Josh Moon. Aaron Cloward is a 26-year-old native of Utah, raised in a small farming community of Mount Pleasant. In high school, Aaron served various leadership positions in school and church, such as seminary council and senior class vice president. After serving full-time in a Spanish-speaking mission for the California Ventura Mission, he continued to serve in the church leadership roles in the Elders Quorum Presidency as secretary and later as president of the LDS fraternity, Sigma Gamma Chi, at Dixie College in St. George. Aaron came out in 2000 when he moved to Salt Lake City. About a year later, he started Gay LDS Young Adults. He lives with his partner, Stephen, in Murray. Stephen, the partner, was born and raised in Medford, Oregon. He is 24 years old and is the second of three children. Stephen served a mission, full-time mission, in the Denmark-Copenhagen mission from 1999 to 2001. Stephen, when he moved to Utah to attend Brigham Young University. After starting his own coming out process, Stephen left BYU and is now in his first year as a pharmacy student at the University of Utah. Stephen now also lives in Murray, where he was involved in Gay LDS Young Adults and the Salt Lake Couples, a social group for GLBT couples. With that, I am asking each panelist, to speak for approximately 10 minutes, and that will guarantee time for questions and answers and some more of my own comments. Jed.
Hi, my name's Jed Brubaker. I can sort of go anywhere with this. I guess one of the most pertinent things to talk about when you are talking about GLTB issues, coming out, questioning, is identity. It's this, the most unsalient thing you can possibly imagine. What is identity? Who am I? And for a teenager, for someone who is coming out, we know that the average coming out age for men is about, 15, 16, women 16, 17. For someone who's anywhere in that age, who am I, period, is hard to cover, let alone who am I gay, and am I shunned by society and by the culture I was raised in. I think one of the the reason I ended up as the Director of Youth Services is because when I was 15 and 16, there was another Director of Youth Services, Allison Beam, and I was able to talk to her, and she was able to talk to me back. And just being able to talk about the forbidden, what you can't talk about, to not be judged, figure out who you are, why, what's important to you, and how to incorporate aspects of your identity into what eventually will be who you will become, was so crucial to me that when Affirmation, when all the head honcho people in Affirmation asked me if I would do this, I willingly said yes. I mean, it was the least I could do to give back. My personal stories, I come from a family of 10, so large Mormon family, grew up in Holiday, son of a bishop. That didn't go over so well. I think I went through a pretty typical coming out experience for the time. I think one of the most important things when you're trying to understand what's important to an individual and how their coming out story is shaped is the age at which they begun it. You're probably going to hear very different stories from Aaron and Stephen. I started, you know, my whole process when I was 14, 15, and I'm sure you guys had your questioning stages, but it sounded like you embarked mostly after your mission. I never got to that point. And you know, like many, I went off to see a counselor, did the reparative therapy bit. They had progressed beyond the shock therapy at this point, so I avoided that. But had lots of time to talk. Fortunately, I had a clinician who was more concerned with therapy and less concerned with reparative, and he figured that would come along in due time. And so I'm a strong advocate that every teenager needs a therapist, because there's a lot of things you can't tell your parents. And just like Allison was instrumental in giving me a form through which to communicate and figure out what was important to me, that therapist was really important to me as well in helping me realize that I didn't really want anything to do with what he was talking about, and that I was okay the way I was. That's sort of, you know, a really big point, becoming okay with who you are. I get emails, as the coordinator and director, whatever I am today, I get these emails, and they're always youth and distraught. No youth is going to say, yeah, I think I might be gay, and, you know, what time's dinner? When you write an email to someone you don't know, to an organization that looks pretty sketchy from within the LDS world, you know, that's sort of a scary thing. I mean, I had my letter to Affirmation, and it was in a desperate moment. And so I get emails in desperate moments, and the first thing I always have to do is tell the kid not to kill themselves, which, you know, sounds awfully dramatic, but that's the real truth. I'm always using the Trevor Hotline, which is this great, you know, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender questioning hotline. It's 1-800 number, Canada, US. Use it all the time. Make sure the kids put it in their wallet. And I'd like to think that I've saved a couple lives. And, you know, and then from there, after they realize that there's someone they can talk to, then they usually aren't so bent on killing themselves. And you can get them to some, you know, good mental health services in their area. So that's been really rewarding for me. I came out, after I was done with my whole bit of therapy, I came out when I was about 16, 17. And so that was my senior year. And you know, it went a lot better than I thought. I think youth always, they see the end of the world. And you know, being a teenager is hard for anyone, and being a teenager for gay youth, I would think it's harder. Maybe that's me petting my ego. But yeah, I think it's pretty rough. And for someone to make it through that, they deserve a lot of commendation for that. And you know, then they can go on to more liberal places, leave the state, find what they need to. But it's all about identity. You have to find out what's important to you and how that's going to work out. For a lot of people, you know, a big question in this panel is, how do you preserve your LDS identity? For a lot of people, that means, yeah, I'm gay, but that's okay. The LDS church is more important to me. Other people say, you know, what LDS identity? Whew, I'm done. Which sort of, in my experience, tends to be the more common route. When you're a teenager, you've had a lot less experiences. You're more pliable. And, you know, after you've gone, I sort of see the mission as the key point. After you've gone on a mission, you have this really big foundation in your life that you have to reconcile things against that. If you don't have that kind of experience, you can sort of create things on your own. For me, when I came out, I decided, you know, the LDS church is very important to me. I'm going to still be LDS. And, you know, for a while, that meant I was going to church. And then I sort of moved to a different church that would allow me to believe, be Mormon, but gay. And so you see all these little compromises in how you reconcile your identity. I think most youth who grow up in a conservative foundation sort of create a mindset of dual identities. They create, you know, this is the outside me and this is the inside me. And so I remember, you know, being the perfect Mormon who would go to church and fulfill all my responsibilities and come home and in my own personal time, you know, be able to realize some of the more gay-related issues that I was working through. And they were really compartmentalized. When I was, you know, in my own little world, I could deal with that. When I was putting on a presentation for the world, then gay didn't exist. So I think a lot of it, you know, is finding people through which to reflect what's going on, finding someone who you can very safely talk about that private. So you sort of start creating those bridges between your inside self and your outside self to create what will eventually become your real self. Did you want me to cover anything else? I think that's it. You guys can ask me all the questions you want.
I want to start out, I guess I should start out by introducing myself. My name is Aaron Cloward. To begin, I think that we should give Jed another hand just because the fact of the work that he does, the work that he puts into the hard task of helping people stop themselves from killing themselves, gay suicides and things like that, because I know it's a really tough job, and if you save one life, it's really worth it. So I want to give Jed another hand. I want to start out, I guess, from the beginning, from where I, my history. I grew up in a small town called Mount Pleasant. I usually say, oh, just some small central Utah town, because not very many people know where that's at. It's in the central part of Utah, obviously, if it's a central Utah town. It's down by Snow College area in Manti, if you're not familiar with Utah. When I came out, my history, tying back into growing up in a small town, was what made the whole coming out process a lot more difficult. When I was raised in a small town, the thought processes and the way people think, I guess, in a small town isn't exactly open-minded always. Isn't exactly liberating, isn't exactly all the things that you would hope it would be in a great place to live. I loved the place that I lived. I loved where I grew up. I wish things were just a little bit more open-minded in my experience growing up. I wasn't raised as an active member of the church, however. My family, I have an LDS background and history, ancestors who crossed the plains and all those good stories that you hear from grandma and grandpa. But I wasn't raised active in the church. In fact, all of my ancestors, or all my relatives, aunts, uncles, cousins, were baptized as children of record, or in other words, when they're 8 years old, they were baptized and they had the baptismal service and never went back to church again. So coming from that kind of background was really interesting later on when I did come out, because things came full circle again. Even though I wasn't raised as an active member of the church, in high school, I had an interesting experience because I wasn't active. In fact, I had really some negative feelings about the church. The bishop always calling me in, wanting to interview me, wanting me to come back to church when I wasn't wanting to. But when you come from a small town where the population is majority are LDS, sometimes things happen that people don't even raise an eyebrow to. When I was starting high school, I didn't enroll in seminary, even though the huge percentage of the high school were in seminary. But when I got my schedule back, my class schedule, I saw release time seminary, and I threw a fit. I had this big tizzy fit because the counselor had put me in seminary. Well, my grandma said, well, you know, just, who wasn't active either, she said, well, you know, go just pretend like it's a history class, because they were studying Old Testament at the time. So I did, and I just went, just, okay, this is just a history class, I'm just going to go. And in about 2 weeks of sitting in seminary, I loved it. I was loving every minute of it, and from that point on, I started becoming more active in the church, and that eventually led me to serve a full-time mission. Now, during all this time, I had things going on in my mind and in my head that were weird, and they were foreign. Things of realizing attractions to the same sex, and wanting to be around my guy friends more than I want to be around all my girlfriends, and not really understanding why I was feeling that. So I just kind of just put it off. I didn't even think about it. I knew that they were there, the feelings were there, but I didn't want to deal with them. So I went on my mission, and I came back, and the feelings intensified and were stronger and stronger. And so I started like thinking, well, maybe could I be gay? No. I thought, this is just, it's some kind of a satanic voice in my head that's trying to convince me that I'm doing, that something's not right here. And no, you're not gay. You're just, you have a strong spiritual bond to your other brothers in the church. Okay, well, maybe that's it. Well, that obviously wasn't it. It was a stronger bond than I was expecting it to be. So I came home from my mission, and I started looking into different organizations that were particularly, that were LDS, but also had some kind of an association with homosexuality, with the GLBT community. I ran into Affirmation. I remember running into Family Fellowship, and read through some of those things. But at the time, I was so, like Jed touched on, when you come home from your mission and you have that established base, that I don't know if this is a good word to use, indoctrination. When you run across something that isn't exactly an organization that the prophet would be promoting in general conference, it kind of makes you a little nervous and a little scared, and you don't know if who's watching me look at this website, I might get in trouble. And so I was really nervous about that. I wanted to investigate this. I wanted to see if there were other people, other LDS people who were feeling the same thing that I was feeling. So I did the same thing. I wrote a letter, just like Jed did, only my letter didn't go to Affirmation or Family Fellowship. My letter went to Evergreen. And those of you who are not familiar with Evergreen, Evergreen is an organization that the church somewhat endorses and somewhat doesn't endorse, here, not officially anyway, that helps people change their sexual orientation. So I became involved in Evergreen for about a month. I stopped going to Evergreen because the experiences that I had there seemed to be dragging me down more than building me up. The experiences that I had there were great, though, because I got to meet other people who were going through the same thing as that I was, and for that, it was a very rewarding experience that I'm glad I did. However, I kept evolving, and things kept changing, and thoughts kept coming into my mind about what I could do. I'm not getting enough from Evergreen. I've got to look farther and see what I can find. So I did. And found some great groups, some great organizations. All during this time, too, I started meeting people, friends, online. I started dating people, different people I'd find in chat rooms and things like that, which was a really, really sick, scary experience when you're first coming out, because there's some weird people out there, especially in chat rooms. And when you're trying to find just someone, anyone to identify with, you're almost willing to push extremes and do things you normally wouldn't do just so that you can identify with these people, so you don't feel so alone. Well, I made friends, took a little while, and my position in the church, when I first started coming out, went through a whole big spectrum of ideas. The first thought I had was, well, okay, I'm gay, but I'm going to be celibate. I'm not going to do anything. I've been endowed. I've taken covenants. I'm not going to do anything that's going to break the covenants that I've made. Later, when you meet somebody that you have special feelings for, and you start feeling romantic feelings toward them, though that challenge in your mind of thinking, well, yeah, I did make those covenants, but I really like this person. So that comes into the picture. Okay, well, so I decide, okay, I'll be gay, but I'm not going to do anything really bad. I'm just going to cuddle with somebody or maybe even kiss. And I'll still be able to go to the temple if I do that because I'm not doing anything sexual or anything wrong. So that went through that phase. Then as you fall deeper in love with somebody and feelings get more deep and intensified, sexual feelings become even more intense and the temptation, I guess, if that's a good word to use, gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So then I get into this mindset of thinking, okay, well, I'm going to be gay, and I still want to go to church, but you know, I'm a human, and I want to be able to love people and express my love to other people just like another couple could. And so I decided to finally go to my bishop, and I've been told previous bishops about my experiences before, and because I was on the mindset of wanting to change and I was going to change my orientation and that things, they were, oh, go get it, be valiant, you'll do great, I'm not worried about you. But when I came out to this bishop and said, you know what, bishop, I think I want to spend my life with another guy. I've fallen in love with somebody, I want to share my life with them just like you get to share your life with your spouse. His first reaction was, you know, took him off guard because it was almost like he had never counseled anybody on a same-sex subject before. So he was really taken off guard, but he was very, very compassionate, which was really, really nice. He said, well, don't worry. I'm going to talk to the stake president. We'll see what we can do. And I said, and he said, well, what would you think about just living with somebody but not being sexual with them? And I said, I could try. And he said, well, that's all that matters. Just try and give it your best. So I said into that, I thought, okay, well, maybe, and I went home to think about that. He said, look, come back in a week, we'll talk about this a little bit more. I did, and I thought about it. Oh, I was so excited because I thought, wow, this bishop is telling me I can actually live with somebody that I care about, and he doesn't care if I'm gay or whatever, as long as I don't have sex. I thought, I can try this. I'm going to try this. I went back to the bishop the next week, and he definitely got some words of counsel from the stake president on how to deal with the issue. And the second meeting was not like the first at all. The second meeting was very harsh, very hellfire, brimstone, cast you into the pit kind of thing. He actually told me a couple of times that I was rejecting Christ, that I didn't love Christ if I was going to do this, if I was going to live this way. And that set off red flags to me immediately because I thought, how can this person tell me that I don't love Christ? How can this person look into my heart and tell me what I believe and what I don't believe? So that really hurt me. And then he reminded me too of how I was failing all my ancestors and all the people I hadn't done temple work for, along with a couple other things. I went home that day, and luckily my house was right behind the church, so I walked and took a few steps and just was in tears. Barely made it into my apartment and was that was it. I was done. No more. I couldn't do it anymore. I had really bad allergies, grabbed several boxes of Benadryl and popped the pills all out and was ready to go because that was it. I couldn't handle it anymore and I couldn't handle the pressure. Somehow, with somewhere deep inside of me, I had the instinct to call my mom because whenever I've hurt before, my mom's always been there. So I talked to my mom and things changed. I got help. I got into counseling and things were better. But as I came out of this depression, I was stuck in this not knowing what to do with the rest of my life now. And also facing the obstacle of, where do I go now? I can't go to church. I still have these feelings. My testimony is still there for the gospel. What do I do? So one thing led to another in my mind. And I'll talk a little bit more about this one during the question and answer period. But to make a long story short, I started a group for gay LDS young adults because I thought there's nowhere for people who are in my position to go to feel acceptance and love from other people of their own age, to know that they're not alone, and to do things that are just fun instead of sitting around talking about homosexual issues or identity crisis or all these other things, just to socialize and have fun. And so that's what we did. And in March of 2001, we held our first activity. We went hiking and there was about 15 of us. And the organizations have been going now for about 2 years. And that has been very, very instrumental in my coming out and bringing me to the point where I am today, which Stephen will talk about now a little bit, about how he got involved in the organization and how it eventually led us together too. So thanks.
I just have to say, Aaron doesn't try very hard anymore. But anyway, like it was said earlier, I'm originally from Oregon. I was born and raised there, actually in Central Point, but Central Point's basically Medford, if anyone's from Oregon, and they probably don't know where Medford is anyway, so it doesn't really make a difference. A family of five. Wasn't really raised in the church to begin with, but my mom was inactive when we were all born, and my dad was not a member of the LDS Church, and so as we grew up, my mom decided that she wanted us to have a religious background and started having us go to primary activities and such not, and eventually had the missionaries come over and talk to my older sister and then to me, and eventually we all got baptized, and my mom started going to church again, and my dad came around later in his life. He was the black sheep of the family for a while until, I don't really remember if it was me or my older sister, but we went up to my dad and asked him why he wasn't going to church with us. And he said he couldn't argue with that, and so that's why he started to go. And so I come from a pretty strong LDS background, and I started dealing with feelings of homosexuality about the time I was 11 or 12, maybe earlier. But I just remember them more vividly around 11 or 12 and 13, because that's when I could really tell. But I put it off as I was just a phase, and it wasn't me. It was just me acting out on certain temptations, and so I always put that out in my back of my mind and pressed forward to try to really strive to be the best. I guess you'd say Peter priesthood that I could, and. I went to Oregon State my first year of college. Up there I really dealt with my own testimony and where I stood, because I no longer had my parents around me, which were my driving force in a lot of things I did, because I pretty much lived my life to please my parents. because I knew how disappointed they were in my older sister, who had became inactive and was no longer really a member of the LDS Church. And so I made myself be the next in line, and I wanted to make sure that I made my parents proud. And so that year I decided that 100% sure that I was going to go on an LDS mission. And I had to do a little cleaning up before I could go, but I left, and I loved the entire 2 years. I never felt closer to my God than at any other point in my life. It's amazing what a mission will do for you, any sort of mission. Even if you're doing stuff for the Peace Corps, you rely heavily on your Heavenly Father for things. But anyways, it was ironic because on the flight home from Denmark, I was coming back from flying over from London. I was sitting there. I said to myself, okay, I'm going to need to stay away from the internet and anything suggestive, because then that's just, I'm going to be on a, you know, downward road from there. Well, about after a week of being home, I started realizing that the feelings I had weren't going away, and so I decided then that, you know what, I'm going to go to BYU, because if I throw myself back into a rich LDS culture, then I will guard myself in sense. Or I once had someone relate temptation and sin to one of the chapters in the Book of Mormon about when Zarahemla came under siege, and that we need to make sure that our walls are strong so that when we become under siege that we'll be able to repel our temptations. And so I thought, well, I've got to get those walls back up. I'm going to go to BYU. I know that's where I need to be. And plus, one of my missionary companions compared the Institute, or the BYU, as the Celestial Kingdom. And so I thought, well, I mean, that can't be that bad down there. And, well, I got to BYU and really started dealing with a lot of the feelings I had, because it was really evident anymore. I dated, but I didn't date very much. Usually, I told all my friends that I had a three-date rule, that by the third date, if I'm still interested, I'm going to marry them, because usually about after the second one, I would get bored and no longer want to date. But I decided that there had to be other people that felt like I did, and that I wanted to find a support group or someone that I could talk to about this. And so I got on the internet, and living in BYU approved housing, I swore that the honor code was directly linked to my computer, and they were monitoring every, you know, type I put into the computer. And so I was very, very paranoid about it. But I came across a website talking about gay LDS young adults, and I was interested in it, and I signed up for to receive their emails. But that's all I did, and I would look at the website and see what their activities were. And when the day of the activity came, I'd sit in my room, and they're going, oh, should I go? And I never went, but I would then look at the pictures from the activity and go, oh, look how much fun they look like they're having. I really want to go. And at that time, they had a program called the Big Brother program, where someone would come and meet you, and you could kind of know someone before you went to an activity. And I thought, oh, I can maybe do that. And so I signed up for that. But when I got the first email from the guy, and I emailed him back, and he emailed me back, and that went on for about 3 months before I built up enough courage even to call him, because I felt like I was betraying everything I was, everything I'd learned, my entire being. I was betraying it. I was betraying my family. But I decided to meet him, and it wasn't as bad as I thought. I was super nervous, and he's all, well, do you want to meet somewhere private? I said, no, nowhere private. I want to be anywhere private with you. I'll meet at a mall. And so as we were walking around, and I always felt that someone else needed to tell me what I was, because that's what I always got from my family. I never really learned to live for myself. And I asked him, I'm like, well, what do you think I'm gay? And he's all, well, I don't think anyone can make that choice for you. But if I had to say in a heartbeat right now, yes, you are. And I looked at him like, I don't believe that. I just think this is something I have to overcome. That was about a year ago. and through him, I met some other people. I really never really attended the GLYA activities because it was just too much for me to handle. It was too much input. I like to keep things small and away from large crowds because I was afraid someone would see me from BYU or other stuff. But it came down to, I was in June of last year, I think it was about the 6th or 7th, I can't remember, I'd have to look up the date. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning and I was sitting in my room by myself and I just broke down and started crying. And it was the first time in my entire life that I was able to say, I'm gay, out loud. And it was devastating to me. I mean, I wish I could say it was like this big relief off my chest, but it was like, I'm gay. I mean, what's this gonna translate out to? Because my entire life was the church. That's what I've been holding on to all these years. And so during the summer, I really dealt with that, and I'm still dealing with it today. But I decided that I didn't really want to talk to a bishop about it because I felt that I could make my own decisions. I was old enough to make my own decision. This was a private matter. It wasn't something I need to involve the church because I knew the teachings of the church. I knew what I was doing. I knew what they were going to tell me, and I didn't want to hear it. And so I kept hanging out with my friends, and then I went to one GLYA activity, stayed 15 minutes, and then made my friend take me home. I was like, I can't do this. But eventually, and I met Aaron that day too, but I wasn't really interested in talking with anyone. I wanted to be by myself and so forth. Later, my friend Adam said, well, Aaron wants to, you know, meet you and talk to you about how things are going. And so we met for lunch at a Fazoli's. And when he walked in the door, I leaned over to my friend. I'm like, is that Aaron? He's all, yeah, I don't remember him being that cute. Anyways, we started dating and now we're together. And I started attending the activities mostly because he was in charge of them. And so he had to do them on Saturdays. And I thought, well, I don't want to spend my Saturday alone. If he's going to go to these activities, I'm going to have to go with him. And it was a big step for me. But during that time, I told my family, and that in itself is another entirely long story that I won't get into here. But I decided that back in August of last year that I needed to know where I stood with my Heavenly Father. And so I went for a walk, and I ended up on Temple Square, and I walked on top of the new conference center, and I was up there all by myself. It was kind of a chilly day, and so I was standing up there, and I said a prayer. That's, I mean, what I was taught to do. And I said, Heavenly Father, this is who I am, and I'm going to run with it. And sorry, this is the estrogen in me. And as a young child, you're always taught to listen for that still small voice, and it said to me, I understand. It wasn't like, all right, go ahead, go out and take that flag out and be as proud as you can, but it was, I understand, because I said, I know you've set out certain things for me to do, but I don't think I'm going to be able to accomplish those for you, from my perspective from the LDS Church. And I just had a really good feeling inside, and it said, I understand. And so, I'm not as, well, it's Sunday school every weekend. It doesn't mean you're even going to church, but don't give up on that part of you. I think it's, you spend so much time building it up that it's a shame to throw something that's has helped you so much in your life already. For most people, I assume it's helped. I know it's kept me alive a lot of the times. But anyways, that's me in a nutshell. So if you have any questions later, I'll be happy to answer them. Thanks.
Trying to decide where to go with this, because I didn't know what any of them were going to say other than, you know, the questions that I had asked. I think what we'll do is we'll open it up to a couple of questions, and then I have a little bit something to share with a question to follow that I will give to our three panelists. And since we've got two mics here and one of them is recording the session, You can either come up here and ask the question so it's on the tape, or you can say it and then I will try to repeat it, and then we'll have whoever fills in the panelists here wanting to come up and answer, and we'll go that way. We'll see how that works. So the first question. Okay, well, a question directed to Aaron about reparative therapy and how he felt that it dragged him down.
Thank you for the question. It actually, when I was speaking about Evergreen, I wasn't ever involved in an actual reparative therapy with a therapist. When I was speaking about how I felt that I was dragged down by my experiences with Evergreen, one of the reasons was because, and I'm not sure the process that Evergreen does now at its meetings, but when I was attending, everybody met, that was divided into geographical chapters or organizations, depending on where you lived, and they were held at secret, undisclosed church meeting houses. You'd go, scared to death, just walk in this room, and it was usually in a high council room, and you meet all these people who are sitting around a high council table, and you don't know if they're all gay or if who's what, and or if they're administrators or if they're from the church or who they are. And when I went, I was really open to it, but when people started discussing, the whole point of the meeting where people would go around and tell everybody else how their life was horrible, or at least that's what was going on at the meetings that I went to. So people went around and discussed, oh, my life is bad because I'm married and I have children and everybody hates me and blah, 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 blah. The next person would say, oh, I'm whatever my problem is. And people would go around and nobody was offering solutions. Nobody was offering, well, this is how I deal with it. Once in a while, somebody would say, oh, I'm having a hard time with my wife. And another married person would say, well, you know, let's talk about this. We can work through this. But that was very, very rare. After the big group meeting, everybody split up into micro groups and basically did the same thing all over again. And you just went around, and they were consisted of maybe about two or three people in each micro group, and you told your story about where you were at and what you're going through, and ended up just being a big whine and complain session about how life sucks. Especially when you're gay and LDS. So that's why it dragged me down, is because I went and it just, there was no hope. There was nothing to look forward to except for the fact that, and the reason why I went back and kept going back was because it was just so nice to finally meet other people who were gay and LDS, and I didn't feel so alone.
I grew up as a big city boy, and when I was in my high school, it was 3,000 students, and there were about 100 Mormons in the high school. And I knew I was gay when I was 11. I didn't know the word, and when I was 12, I went to the library, and I'd heard homo, and so I started looking in the index under homo, and I kept going through everything until I finally found homosexuality, and then I read everything I could about it. But I was closeted. I stayed closeted all the way through high school, all the way through most of my adult life. And I'm wondering, since you, most of you, grew up in small communities, would you recommend that high school students come out? Or would you recommend that they stay closeted until they're out of the high school environment? Because you, almost all of you, also commented about how difficult it is being a teen under any circumstances.
I think the issue of coming out in high school is, I mean, you all could have guessed what I'm going to say. It's an individual decision. And actually, the way that, in my experience with the youth that I've worked with, the way they feel about it is probably the biggest predictor of success they're going to have. If someone's gung-ho about coming out, they're probably going to have enough internal identity integrity to be able to make it through any level of adversity, provided that they have support. So what, you know, if someone, and then if someone doesn't want to, then they don't even have usually the support from themselves to make it through. So it's not a good idea. So I guess, you know, overall answer is push the person in the direction that they want to go. And if they decide that they're going to come out, try to give them all the support that they can get. Try to hook them up with resources, like, you know, local community organizations where they can interact with their peers who will end up being their largest social support group.
I wanted to add something to that.
I forgot to mention before, and this has kind of brought refreshed my memory. Right now, Stephen and I are also we're working on lots of different projects. We have lots of little pet projects. One of them that we're most focused on right now, we're writing a book specifically for young LDS people who are struggling with the issue, and it's a really, really hard thing to tackle because we're trying to tackle tough questions that people have about coming out in. When they're in such a tight-knit Mormon family. The purpose of the book, though, is to do the thing that Mr. Quinn talked about, to help people feel that they're not alone. And it's supposed to provide, our intent is for it to provide a support when they don't have anybody to talk to, when they have questions, especially when they're in that kind of a position where they, should I come out? What should I do? I have all these questions. And so that's what we're trying to work on right now. So people don't, if they're in that position, they'll have a place to turn to.
I think that's a very interesting question and telling of how society has changed. I know I'm close to Mike's age, and I came out 20 years ago. I was 24 years of age, which when I came out was about the average at that time. And in the past 20 years, it has dropped clear down to 14 to 16 years of age for men. When I was coming out, women tended to be a couple years later. The same is true now, but still in their late teens. Or if they got married and were in a tradition that really forced them into marriage, back 20 years ago, they tended to come out 35, 45 years of age. Now, if they do get pushed into a marriage, they still tend to come out younger. They're coming out in their mid to late 20s, sometimes early 30s. And there are always exceptions to that. But I think it's interesting in how our culture has changed. When I came out, there were basically zero positive examples in movies, TV, or mainstream top 10 books. And now we've got Will and Grace and Ellen a couple of years ago, and things have changed. We also are talking a little more about other issues, and I want to get into a couple of those and hopefully put this in the context of a bigger picture. And a bigger picture in how we can address and create a better society. Are there any other questions before I move on to that? Okay, Mike, and then Hugo.
After LDS men come home from their mission, and they start figuring out that they're gay, the number one responsibility that most of us feel is that we need to get married. And my question is what can you suggest to offer to those young men who are in that transition phase between getting from acceptance to becoming partner? Now, with you guys being partnered, at some point, how did you guys cope and come to some kind of resolution as to decide not to marry, if that was your decision?
Well, Mary.
marriage was foremost on my mom's mind because, my nephew needed a cousin to play with. That was her big concern. And so marriage was always a top subject in my family with me, because my mom thought I'd be married like in 2 months after getting home on my mission. But for me, coping with getting married or going the route like I have gone is, I can't put it in better words than saying that whatever you choose, make sure it's something you want to stick with. Because for me, it was this. I wanted to get married, and because I thought also that would help me, but then I would thought, could I really get married with someone and live with this and then end up breaking some young woman's heart? You got to think. I think a lot of the times, because most of my life was always thinking about other people, and all of a sudden I was starting to think very selfishly about myself, like, what do I need? What do I want? I stopped thinking about other people, and I thought if I got married, then I would, this would fix it. And then I had to step outside of being selfish and think, I got to think more, like, this decision affects other people, and if I get married and then later decide this isn't something I can live with, I'm going to end up really hurting someone. And so my suggestion is that keep in mind that whatever you do choose, it's something you're willing to stick with. Now, granted, I mean, if you decide to experiment with homosexuality and you decide, okay, this isn't something I can do, there's always a way to come back. But marriage is something that's very locked in. And it's hard to get out of a relationship like that over something, especially if there's children involved. So I always think it's important to think it entirely through to its entirety and make sure it's something that you want to do, not something someone else wants you to do. Because I knew how much my parents wanted me to get married, but it wasn't something I wanted to do. And so it's important to make sure that you do something that you want to do and that you're going to stick with it.
Is it in relation to this question? Okay. Let me. We'll do that in just a second. I'll think back on 20 years to that question, and that was part of what kept me from getting married. And part of it was probably my own circumstance and perhaps the privileges that I had in my life with certain information I was able to gather that created enough question in my mind that I could not follow what I had been taught, and that was to get married. And I'll touch on that in just a second. But being the age that I'm at, I know many of the stories of people who, because they trusted in their leaders, because they did not understand their feelings and where they were at, they did get married because they thought it was the better way, and it wasn't. And from my experience, then, by following less than good advice, the next best step would be to be honest in your marriage about what you're dealing with and then working together for a solution, either to stay in the marriage for what you jointly believe or to end the marriage on ecumenical terms, to raise children in a loving environment that both parents love the children and both parents respect each other for the individual they are, but as separated parents. And so I'll leave it at that.
I think it would be fair to say that you have convinced most of us in the audience, I personally, I'm impressed and for your courage and for the way you have decided to lead your life. Now, how can we in this audience help our neighbors and the people in our wards to understand that homosexuality is not necessarily a perversion, that the proclamation in the family does not apply to gay and lesbian people.
I knew such a tough question was going to come from Hugo.
I was also prepared to ask it if Hugo or someone else didn't.
Oh, good. All right. Well, then at least it got asked. That's a very, very tough question. I think that one of the most important things that people in a ward setting, if any of you are active members of the church, you can take back. And this is a hard thing to do. When I had this discussion with somebody about being whether gay people should be, who are openly gay, should still attend church and still be active. And one of the biggest suggestions that somebody gave was that, yes, you should, because the church and the idea within the church, meaning the people in the church, isn't going to change unless people, it has to change from the inside out. No matter how much people try and write letters to the church or convince the church or write to the first presidency, isn't necessarily as effective as the people who are inside the church spreading the message through the ward. I think so, having the courage to share personal experiences, experiences that you've heard that are close to your family, and having the courage to stand up in priesthood meeting or in Relief Society meeting when somebody says something that just doesn't make you feel right, that you just think, no, that's not true. My son is gay, or my daughter is lesbian, or my granddaughter. And to have the courage to stand up and say, you know what, this doesn't apply to my granddaughter. My granddaughter's a wonderful person. My granddaughter loves God. And to have the courage to stand up and say that. But that takes a lot of courage. So, but I think that one of the most important things that we can do to help everyone and to understand and to promote understanding about the issue is to take compassion back to the ward, to the stake, and to share them with each other so that the message can be spread of love.
We have an audience response to that question, I think. I know.
This is a little tool that some of you might be interested in that answers that same question. It's a guide for LDS families dealing with homosexual attraction. It was written by a group of very involved church people. It was a number of general authorities looked at it and gave us advice on what they thought would be good. And if you want to hand something to a family member, a bishop, a church leader, this would be good.
Where do we get
there's free ones at the back of the room. They're sitting on a table. And there's a website, and we can take a list of others who want them. But there's a website that also is written in that same kind of way. It has Elder Oak's talk as the centerpiece of that. And so I think it's a really good way, if you want to talk to church people, just churchy.
Thank you, Ron.
And that booklet, by the way, is really, really good. I've read it, and I've recommended it to other people, too, because it's really, really hard to find literature on this issue that isn't polarized one way or the other, saying you need to leave the church or you need to go into reparative therapy. This book isn't biased. It just talks about love and acceptance and the most important things. So this is really, really good.
I found it interesting to try and read as many experiences of people who are doing just that, trying to create that safe place in their ward, whether it's parents or our siblings, our brothers and sisters, or ourselves trying to be a part of a church community. There are a few examples of those stories on the Affirmation website. I know Family Fellowship has a lot of good stories in their reunion, a quarterly newsletter of people being those examples in their wards, in their Relief Society, in their
priesthood quorum meetings, etc. Did you, Chris, did you have a question? Well, Hugo, okay, Chris, do you want to come up here or shall I repeat?
In your outreach as a social worker and a therapist in Southern Utah, one of the trends I'm seeing in our agency when we work with gay and lesbian Mormons, or anyone from a religious background, in my age group, those are my age, we went through the whole church process and we have to deal with that issue. I'm noticing, or the trend is that those that we're counseling now that are coming out earlier are leaving the church earlier, and are leaving the church angrily, and are abandoning not just the LDS faith, but all faith tradition. And I'm just wondering, in your outreach, how do you address that? How do you work with it? At least in Southern Utah, we have the Episcopal Church, who is incredible with our services. That's the one place we do groups. I can't get the kids even to come there inside the social hall because it's attached to a church. And their anger addressed to any religious space. Do you have that same trend here, or is it just something maybe in Southern Utah, or have you ever seen or addressed that issue in your reaching out with people?
I guess the point I'd make is that they have real good reason to be angry. They have incredible reason to be angry. I mean, in a sense, you have a whole bunch of youth who are realizing that, you know, oh my gosh, maybe my entire life has been a sham. I think it's an incredibly natural experience to be angry. However, as Chris mentioned, there's this problem that, you know, church-affiliated locations are sometimes the best place to do group interventions and whatnot, and if you can't get them to show up, that's a problem. What I think, what I see as effective is, once again, that interpersonal work on a peer level here in Salt Lake. The YAC, the Youth Activity Center, that's attached to the Gay and Lesbian Community Center, incredible work, all the time. I've seen tremendous good come out of that. For, you know, other people in other places, you have to work with what you get. And, you know, people, it's okay for them to be angry. And give them, you know, 1, 2, 5, 10 years, and it'll probably calm down a little bit. I think almost everyone that, like, comes out very frequently comes out angry. 2 years later, it's not, being angry is exhausting, and it's not that important to them because it's not that big of an issue anymore, and so it sort of falls out of their life. But Chris, you raised a very good point that when they're the most angry is when they need the most help and when it's the hardest to get to them. I think peer support groups are probably the most, you know, incredible and effective tool that we can use.
Yes.
On the rules that we have for fostering healthy relationships and supporting relationships have all been created for, you know, heterosexual relationships. So my question is, when you're kind of on your own with gay relationships, how do you deal with issues of fidelity versus promiscuity? Or would something like civil unions be helpful? You know, it's kind of brand new territory, so how do you decide issues the society rules could then develop within homosexual communities, you know, aren't there to help? How do you think through those issues and in terms of your own integrity and relationship to other people within gay relationships? What helps? How do you think through these?
It's a huge question with many subparts, I think. And there is much happening in the gay, lesbian, transgendered community in that regard. I think there are a couple of things to remember, and that is we think that gay marriage or commitment ceremonies or that for same-sex couples is new, but they have actually existed off and on throughout history in varying communities. That's one start. So we can look to the past for possibilities. But yes, there's a growing number of books on relationships, on creating a same-sex marriage partnership. Do any of you have answers for this one? I think many of the interpersonal lessons that we learn in church, in social settings, in communication workshops have applicable meaning and lessons in same-sex couples just as they have in heterosexual couples. The dynamics are a little different. I myself personally believe much of our gender divisions are cultural. There are some biological differences. But
can I add another dimension to that? And I'm just curious, from an LDS background, how you perceive your relationship with your partners as eternal?
You just had to throw that on there, didn't you? Well, first, I just would like to say that with way of fidelity and how society views homosexual relationships is, this is my personal advice to everyone, don't let society dictate how you live your life. Society has a lot of things that wants other people to fit into their little cookie cutter shape of how life should be, but if you don't live inside that cookie cutter shape, it doesn't mean you're a bad person. It doesn't mean that you're worse off than someone else. And inside of any couple or any relationship, I think there should always be communication. And once you have that communication and there's no deceit, you can decide on where your relationship boundaries are. For example, if in the way of fidelity, if someone wanted to do something that was more sexually adventurous than the other person in the couple, they should come together, talk about it, and find some sort of mid-ground where they could try something so both people are satisfied and people feel comfortable. As way as commitment ceremonies go, me personally, I've always felt that me and Aaron will eventually have one when we have the money. I mean, it's not cheap. But I mean, even just the food for one of those things.
Money for
like the entire thing, the ceremony. Mostly for the vacation afterwards, the little honeymoon. I'm thinking a couple $100 on the ceremony, about $3,000-$4,000 on the vacation. But anyway.
He's just starting pharmacy school, so we've got 4 years left.
But I think that gives something for a lot of people, that for me especially, it gives me something to hold on to, something to work for. And as well as people are saying that allowing gay marriage is going to devalue the relationships in marriages, I mean, if you look today, a lot of marriages ended up in divorce. And I saw this on The Daily Show on Comedy Central, that someone said, well, if marriage is such a sacred institution, then why are we having America marry two people on TV? It's just amazing that way. And from the LDS, can you repeat your question? I can't remember it now.
I'm curious, do you perceive your relationship as eternal?
Like, as in the sense of being, like, sealed in the temple and the whole ceremony thing, no. But at the same time, I couldn't imagine an eternity spending it without my partner. If after this life, in heaven or wherever, what you want to call it, if I would be separated from this point in my life, Aaron, and hopefully continuing throughout my life, if I was separated from Aaron, that wouldn't be a heaven for me. And so I could not conceive an eternity without him. And so from my perspective, I see it as being an eternal love. Whereas the church sees it, they don't. But for me personally, I can't believe that I'll be separated from him just because of who I am. And I have to accept that. I don't know, other people feel differently, but for me personally. So, hope that answered everyone's question.
I'm tacking something onto this, which is gonna pick on Hugo a whole bunch and sort of issue a challenge to all of you. Hugo meant it in all niceness, and I completely forgive him. But when he came up to me today, he said, oh, are you and Josh still together? No one is going to go up to any of my siblings who are married and say, oh, are you still together? When you say, are you still together, it implies that at some point you will not be. And the assumption, default assumption, is that you won't be. I read this somewhere when I was a teenager and have embraced it ever since, that you should say, how are things going? And then if you aren't together, oh, that's too bad. Because that's exactly how it would be. You know, if we were having this conversation in, you know, Ithaca, and all those Cornell students were heard the questions about how is gay marriage different than straight marriage, they would say, well, we were all socialized the same. The actualization of a gay marriage is, you know, with the exception of a little gender variation, is a large part, you know, the goals, objectives, dreams, commitments, it's exactly the same because everyone was raised the same and this is what marriage is, and, you know, at some point you go, oh, well, same gender instead of opposite, okay, that's fine, but I can still have my honeymoon, we can still have the, you know, $4,000 vacation, you know, beach, everything is great. So I guess I would issue a challenge to all of you to be careful about how you refer to relationships, and be careful about how whether you're supporting them or whether you're tearing them down. Because if you think about it, if you say, even if you are Hugo and you are in a gay relationship, if you say, are you still together, on some level or another, you're implying that the relationship has lesser value. So, go do it.
See, that wasn't Hugo's question, though, about marriage. But yeah. Hugo's been, and his partner, John Charles, had a commitment ceremony 2.5 years ago at the Unitarian Church. They had three ministers there.
we didn't say, it was a Unitarian minister who performed our version of the temple ceiling. surrounded by all our gay and lesbian and straight friends, a supportive Mormon community around us, we decided that we wanted to do a temple ceremony because our friends are Mormon. And the minister didn't say that for time and all eternity, but said as long as you love each other and as long as you wish.
Maybe I'm going to get myself in deep water here. But this is connected to education and the church and church members. And I find this extremely important, especially in helping people who are in the process of coming out at whatever age that might be. My particular concern is for youth and young adults. My college degree, other than being in humanities, is in education. And so all the sociology and psychology that goes into when you study to prepare to be a teacher. Let's see. There are many people who are trying to do what they can to educate at the grassroots level, at mid-management level, and at the top. And that also goes for the church. In my involvement across the country with other religions and within my own faith, I have had some conversations down at church headquarters with director or leaders and have sent letters and also have directed letters to other faith leaders. Part of it in an attempt to bring the subject of same-sex attraction into a bigger picture. Religion always talks about creation and God creating and creating Zion, Nirvana, etc. This letter, I think I'm going to read the ecumenical one instead of the LDS directed with a couple of comments, and then we'll close possibly with a song. I write this letter as a person of faith, one who believes in God's love and tries to mirror that love to my fellow siblings on earth, to the best of my understanding and ability. The questions I pose and the information I share is relevant to all world religions, but culturally are connected to the Mormon and the Jewish, Christian, Islamic traditions. The scriptures, Old and New Testament,
Torah, Quran, Book of Mormon, etc., are interesting histories of mankind and its struggle to understand creation and God's will. There are also some interesting interpretations of different passages of Scripture within these traditions. As most are aware, some passages have created some very controversial and heated debates over long periods of time. Some of God's creation has also created huge stumbling blocks for others, especially in regard to race and race history, religion and theology, and gender equality, just to name a few. From the Mormon Jewish Christian Islamic tradition, we have been taught that God created Adam and Eve, male and female. It is in keeping with this belief that some have added not Adam and Steve or Madam and Eve to condemn gay and lesbian couples. Did God really create all the heavens and everything in them? Where do God's children who are intersex fit into the picture? Intersex is a term used to describe several dozen known biological variations from the male and female. People who fall into this intersex category around us every day, in fact, over 2% of the population falls within the intersex category. The American Academy of Pediatrics, the AAP, admits on average 5 intersex children are altered every day in America to make their genitals cosmetically normal. A good synopsis of the research, of the continuing research collected, can be found at the ISNA website, and I've got reference material up here for those who are interested. One interesting intersex variation is testicular feminization. This type of individual looks female and develops in adolescence normally with one exception, no menstrual period. All body parts seem to be right, but instead of ovaries, these individuals have embedded testes. Today, doctors know what to look for, and the testes are surgically removed, since most of these individuals would get testicular cancer and die by their mid-30s. It's usually not discovered, though, until in their teens or early 20s. What do we make of the intersexes regarding religion and relationships? The following questions need to be answered when we consider all of God's creation. For those religions and denominations that believe in pre-existence, what sex were these individuals in our pre-earth life, if sex is eternal? I haven't read or heard any reasonable answer. What sex will they be in the resurrection next life if they get to choose? Then sex, it isn't eternal, at least for some. Are intersex people worthy to receive the priesthood, since some of them have a testicle and a penis as well as an ovary and a vagina, true hermaphrodites? Or what about testicular feminized individuals? Yes, some denominations and religions do ordain women, but many don't. And historically, virtually none did a few years ago. Are intersex persons worthy to have a lifetime companion that God has called good in Genesis, with whom to share life? If an intersex person is operated on, raised as a boy, and given the priesthood, but in adolescence feels he is a girl and is attracted to boys, is this child of God homosexual? Has he or she committed sin? Does she still have the priesthood if ordained in a gender-divided tradition? In the case of testicular feminization, is the celebrated marriage actually a homosexual marriage? Intersex individuals in homosexual relationships are found within all mammalian and in some reptile and bird species. Studies have been conducted and biological differences have been found in some instances between heterosexual and homosexual-oriented subjects. Research on laboratory animals has proven that during a certain developmental stage in the uterus, hormonal interaction will result in a homosexual orientation. Once established, this orientation has not been reversed by additional hormones and drugs. And some of these have been, research has been done at BYU. Studies also suggest that biology plays a role in human sexual orientation. Although the causes are still under investigation, we do know that there are natural God-created components. Unfortunately, people are prone to dismiss that which they don't understand as unnatural or as an abomination. The Bible says to multiply and replenish the earth. Nevertheless, approximately